The Grade Cricketer is a Twitter stream. It's about playing cricket at the grade level.
It's a tough, mean, dirty, dirty business being a grade cricketer.
A lot of cricketers, you know, that's all they know. They've done it since they're 10 and they have a deep-seated fear of change.
But the grade cricket is all about being the most alpha version of yourself as possible at all costs and at all times.
I don't bat or bowl. I just feel the gully, count the number of dot balls in a row, sledge 15-year-olds, make me feel better about myself.
Thanks, champ.
Oh, no, you called me champ.
Hello and welcome to the Grade Cricketer podcast on Fox Sports. Australia have regained the Ashes. We're going to be recapping the Perth Test match. Is Steve Smith still batting? He might be. Mitchell Marsh, he's got 181. The selectors got it right again. We're going to summarise the England camp, the England squad, and the England cricket board, apparently. There's some match fixing going on. Who's the silent man? I don't know. The Big Bash started last night. Two huge guests on, though, this week. Gideon Hay and Simon Kadich. And then, of course, hashtag AskTGC. That's an introduction that's broken into about four different parts. But, hey, here we are. My name is Ian Higgins, and I'm joined by Sam Perry and Dave Edwards. Boys, Australia have won the Ashes. Are you excited by that?
You! Woo!
Yeah, boys. Yeah. Hello, Ian. Yeah, Australia's won the Ashes. People here in England are being noticeably passive-aggressive towards me, so everything's going quite well.
Sure.
What can you say? It's been a dominant display. Have all the takes been said? There's been a million takes on this. I love how it's all just zero sum. Like, Australia were incredible. The fast bowlers are incredible. Steve Smith, you know, is he the best since Bradman? Probably not, but let's say it anyway, because someone always is every couple of years. But the take is obviously that England are terrible.
Yeah.
And cricket's zero sum. Like, I mean, if like Cummins and Hazelwood and Stark are better than the batsmen, then of course the batsmen are going to look bad. I don't know. I don't know.
Pez, you've got it in one. Cricket is binary. Winners and losers, that's all it is. But just the sheer euphoria that I felt as an Australian fan, and just the way that it went down on that fifth day at the WACA, it was just so dramatic. Like, there was the weather concerns. Were we even going to get on? How do professional groundsmen fuck up covers duties that nearly cost us the Ashes? But when Cummins took that final wicket, it just opened the valve and just released all the pressure and all the tension of the previous 12 months. And, you know, there's been pay dispute dramas, all the bewilderment over ageist selection policies and all that kind of stuff just boiled into insignificance when we took that final wicket. And then Channel 9 decided to go the news, and I had to frantically find my remote and switch over to Gem in order to bask in the afterglow. And I couldn't find the channel for about a minute, and I lost all that stuff. So really disappointing from my end. But these are the Ashes, and we've got them back, boys. The most important competition in the world, bar none. And we've got them in our possession once more, although I think they're in the Lord's Pavilion.
So I actually have a contrary view in that I was disappointed massively how Perth played out, because it was just, England have won three tosses in a row now, and I thought that's a big head start in Australia. But, you know, they sort of threw that away in Adelaide. But then I thought, you know, when they put 400 on the board, I thought, okay, that's good. You know, we're in for a good game here. And then just the way it capitulated, and I was like, fuck this. Like, it's boring. Like, can I just say that it's boring because we knew this was going to happen, and everything that we thought is going to happen has happened exactly. You know, like, it's not a contest. And is it that enthralling?
Did you feel at any kind of sense of euphoria or excitement when we took that final wicket, or were you just bored, stiff? This is fucking just sullen. Yuck.
I don't think bored's the right adjective I would use, but I just used it excited twice. I mean, I just didn't feel euphoric. I didn't feel that happy about it. I think maybe it's because Anderson had just been hit in the head horrifically, and the ball went forward from his grill. And I thought, this isn't fun to watch. I wasn't having a nice time enjoying it. So I don't know. Like, I really wanted the contest, and I spoke at length on this podcast and to you boys about how much I wanted Melbourne and Sydney to be live test matches, and we're not getting it, and it's going to be 5-0, isn't it?
It
is going to be 5-0, and let's just get used to that. I mean, or 6 or 13, as has been suggested on this show. And I mean, just to kind of go back over the game, if that's okay. Ian, speaking of things that have been suggested on this show, it was looking very good for both England and us after Johnny Bairstow made his 100 and celebrated precisely as has been suggested. yes. on this show. I just wanted to call that out. Yeah. And just inserting ourselves into the story. At least that part was good.
Unnecessarily, but I apologize for doing so. Okay. But that's not the first time that we've predicted something that's happened in this series. And it just goes to this thing that, like, everything that we saw coming has happened. Alistair Cook, he's gone. He was going to nick off in the first session in Brisbane before people listen to the podcast. Exactly what happened. You know, like, Bairstow scores hundreds, celebrates in exactly the way that we told him to. So, therefore, what I'm saying is we are God.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Cummins gets a last wicket via Mancat at the SCG. Oh, wait. He had the opportunity.
But we are celebrating hard, boys. I mean, I know that we're disappointed with the way it all went down, but, I mean, you can see how hard the Australians have been celebrating already. There's been photos going around of, like, Darren Lehman and Steve Smith kissing the urn in unison, looking seductively down the barrel of the camera. Darren Lehman's head.
Yeah, Steve Smith looks kind of alarmingly, like, seductive in that particular shot. Like,
what's even more alarming for me is the size of Darren Lehman's head in parallel to, like, look at Steve Smith's head, and then you compare it with Darren Lehman's head, and there's no parallax error there. Like, their heads were directly together, but Steve Smith's head is really small, or Darren's head is gigantic. I can't quite tell which one.
Is the takeaway from this, guys, that, like, you know, because we're talking about home series and away series and everything, I mean, there was a lot of conjecture over the selectors and the selections and the process that they went through, but, like, they have been proved, like, 100% correct. Essentially, they plumped for this idea of violent cricket.
Yep.
And violent cricket has won. Everything in Australia is harsh. It's a harsh sun. It's a harsh outback. Yeah. It's a harsh accent. And the cricket has to be harsh too. That's how we played it, violently, with guys that have looked good forever, played in all the 19 side. Doesn't matter what they've done in the lower levels.
Yeah.
And we've come out trumps. You know, Cummins is hitting guys in the head before we win.
Yeah.
We're talking about big heads. You know, Steve Smith can't get out. He's in the backyard. Everyone was right. It's just violent, harsh alpha cricket that wins.
And Mish Marsh just embodied that. I mean, the under-19s captain, as you mentioned. But just the celebration when he got to his 100, he just let out this primal, raw, arms were aloft, just looking to the heavens. I don't think the stump mic actually captured the audio, but I just imagine it would have sounded like the Iron Man roar in those Nutrigrain ads in the 90s. Just this, just something like that. That is what I envisaged.
I think it's going to be the new sound for the Nutrigrain ads if they still exist. Let's talk about Mitch Marsh. Like, you know, Mitch Marsh did, I mean, talking about all of the stereotypes of Australian cricket coming home, Mitch Marsh made a daddy ton in front of daddy in daddy's home. Everything was dad about.
Oh, I was so dad.
And he replaced the beta male Pete Hanscom. Like, I think there's a general consensus in Australian cricket that people feel very sorry for Pete Hanscom, because if ever there was going to be a wicket where he was going to get back in form, it was that wicket against that bowling attack. But you got to say Mitch Marsh batted really well, and the selectors have been proved right. But I mean, you know, replay everything you've just said, Pez. But yeah, dad. Everything was dad.
And speaking of dads, Darren Lehman was really quick to come out after that, though, and say that, you know, he's got to back that up in the next game. He's got to continue to make runs, do the right thing. Yeah. I mean, I only assume that he's contractually obliged to say that. But just, you're only as good as your last innings. Like, great, well done on the 180-odd, but you better back that up with another 180-odd.
It was like... Like, you know, they say it couldn't be scripted better, but it really, like, if you wanted to write a script about the most alpha way Australia could have won or regained the Ashes, you would say it'd be at Perth, it'd be Steve Smith not being able to get out, the Perth boys succeeding, you know, hitting guys in the head, then winning, all of that kind of stuff, England guys making hundreds in losing sides. What about Mitch Marsh talking about how he celebrated his 100 by basically going home and staring at a scorecard for about half an hour, just looking at the numbers going through his head? I mean, none of us can say that we haven't done that. You know, we've all been there, haven't we?
I've been that guy. I'm still that guy because, when you know, my first 100 I ever scored under 10 reps, Southeastern Premier Oval, 116. My dad actually framed that scorecard for me. So whenever I'm having a tough time at work or at home, I'll go back to my parents' house. And I'll go into that room and just stare at that scoreboard and just all the little, you know, little pencil marks, little triangles. Fuck, scorecards are just a thing of beauty. Like, whoever created the scorecard just deserves some graphic design award, just the way it's all laid out. So much information on one page. Like, it's unbelievable, actually, when you think about it.
I mean, it's interesting because I mean, the way Pez introduces all of our international cricketing guests and sometimes even not even then, he describes them by the numbers, because we are just all just these numbers. And like, I've never felt closer to Mitch Marsh in my life than when he said, I just looked at the scorecard. Like, he would have just would have like breathed in like all like the maidens, the dots. Like, you know, he's just, oh, yeah, I struggled for a little bit there. Oh, yeah, I remember that shot. That was a nice shot. He would have gone through every single one of his 250 rocks.
It's like how dev guys just stare at paragraphs of code all day, just zeros and ones, just numbers. Like, they mean everything. Just the building blocks of our reality is founded on numbers. And same with cricket.
In many ways, though, it's a rare kind of departure from the alpha cricketer that Mitch Marsh kind of gets selected upon. I mean, the alpha cricketer is meant to be too cool for cricket, aren't they? They're meant to kind of hate cricket but still succeed with levers and pipes regardless. But he's kind of let slip that after making 181, he just stared at his scorecard all night.
Yeah, I mean, so he has revealed he's a cricket nerd there. Yeah. I just want to ask you guys about like body line. Because I think we're literally watching Bodyline in 2017. How did you guys feel when you were watching that final session when Cummins and Stark, they're basically bowling around the wicket and they're bowling at the batsman? And a lot of people will say that's fine. And I'm not saying it's necessarily wrong. I'm just saying that we're literally watching Bodyline, and like the objection of the bowlers is to try and hit them, right?
I feel a little bit uneasy. I mean, obviously, there was a tragedy many years ago which kind of shaped cricket in Australia in particular, inevitably, forever. But ever since then, you know, there is this kind of uneasiness when a short ball happens. It's almost like there is a cognitive dissonance. You know, you bowl bouncers, but you don't expect them to actually hurt someone. But when they do, you're really worried. But you still bowl the bouncers because that's all you've ever known. You have to intimidate. But when you hit someone, scary. And I don't know how you reconcile that as a fast bowler. Obviously, you have to have some form of cognitive dissonance and disassociate yourself from it. But obviously, we've done really well. But when he did hit Anderson, it really was a vicious blow to the helmet. Mate, I was pretty fucking hectic.
At that stage, there was like still 3 hours of play to be had. And it was obvious that Australia were about to win. And I was just thinking, like, Anderson should just turn around and just kick his stumps over. Like, don't put yourself through it, Jimmy. Like, it just made me feel really uncomfortable. Maybe that's me being weak and un-Australian. Almost definitely that's been what the feedback has been on my Twitter account in the last few days. But, yeah, like, if that was me just facing Cummins and he's trying to bolt at me and then he's hitting me,
kick his stumps and just walk
just
away.
Just kick him over, mate. Just be the West Indian number five, Sunil Ambrose. Just turn around and kick him over. Like, let's just get this over. Just stay on your feet. Anyway, England. What does this mean for them? Where are they at? Where are England at? Like, are they going to make any changes? They're fucked, aren't they? It's grim.
Yeah, I don't know if there's much else to say about it. It's just been just a complete, completely comprehensive. And Dan Briddick's going to be able to write another book called Whitewash to Whitewash 2.
All right then, Gideon Hay, the master, coming up next.
This is the story of all those Saturday afternoons you said to yourself, why? This is the story of when it's all you've ever known and you have a deep-seated fear of change. This is the story of what happens when you used to be good. This is the story that began in 1882 and finished with your father still not turning up to watch you play. This is the story of unemployed middle-aged men who sledge 15-year-olds and give send-offs to players that are younger and already better than them. Of part-time uni students trying to make it back into second grade. Of men who turn up the training in suits just to appear intelligent. Of men who lie to their wives when the game is called off. Of blokes who bat eight and don't bowl. Of the all-time circuits that are paid for by club presidents with offshore bank accounts and mail-order brides. This is the story of the endless pursuit of the Triple C. The century, the circuit, the chop. This is the story of Nugsy, of Bruiser, of Chooker, of Nathan, of Robbo. This is the story of Dad. This is the story of what to do when the game's just not that into you. This is the story of change, of fitting in again, of finding yourself. This is the story of Lara. This is for every partner who doesn't understand the LBW rule. This is for everyone who's ever asked, who's winning? This is the gift guide for that nephew that you haven't spoken to in 12 months, and you heard he likes cricket. He won't soon. This is the story of a father-son match, a poker match, a Tinder match, a match that finally broke me. This is the story of a circuit, a chop king, of incongruous French history, of Nugsy's car, of our darkest day as best friends. This is the story of reconciliation, of popped collars, of Mark Waugh's cover drive, of what it's like to lose the only thing you've ever loved. This is the story of my life. Your life. Of every lifeless wicket on a Saturday afternoon. This is the Grade Cricketer. Tea and no sympathy.
Well, it's an absolute pleasure to have a major luminary in the cricket writing, just the cricket sphere generally, on the show for the second time as well, we should add. He's also our fixer, which is an inappropriate word, given that he helped us get Mark Atherton on last week. I'm talking, of course, about Gideon Haigh, who's we've dialed in from his home in Melbourne on a landline, one of the rare times we get to use a landline, so hopefully the quality is good. Gideon, welcome to the show again.
Nice to be back.
Very good. I just, you know, that's so authoritative. You've been following the cricket, Gideon. You've been in the press box, as far as I understand, for the last three tests. I mean, what sum up the Ashes for us? So there's been about a million takes a day. You know, what's your abiding thought about what we've just seen? Australia's up 3-0. What are we watching? What are we looking at?
Well, I think my overwhelming impression is how closely the series has adhered to the predictions made in advance. I mean, often cricket kind of bemuses you because it takes on a life of its own and defies prediction. But I think a lot of people thought that Australia's advantage in its own conditions would be considerable, and that the three-pronged pace attack would be formidable against a team that had, you know, pretty limited and pretty mediocre preparation coming into it. A lot of people were critical of the England side when it was chosen back in September, and lo and behold, a lot of those criticisms have been borne out. A few of the England players haven't performed. You know, the bankers in Root's side, players like Cook and Anderson and Broad, haven't had the impact that was hoped for. Curiously, you know, probably some of the newer players have made an impact, like Milan and Overton, players that we hadn't seen in Australia before. But other than that, it's unfolded, in a way to kind of reassert Australia's excellence in its own conditions, which of course has the quid pro quo that we're bullies at home, and we sometimes are a bit meek and apologetic away.
So if we could just focus on England just for the time being, Gideon, I mean, everyone sort of had their say about what they would do for the fourth and fifth test matches. But, I mean, what would you do? Would you keep Cook at the top of the order? Would you stay with Milan? And would you change the bowling attack? Would you introduce Crane? What would you do for Melbourne?
Oh, jeez. Well, I mean, the problem with schedules like this is that no one ever has the opportunity to make a claim for a place. You might remember that Gary Balance was picked in this squad. You might remember that Gary Balance probably has a difficulty in remembering that. He probably thinks he's just here for a holiday. Jake Ball, I don't even know whether he's injured or not. I'm not sure that it makes all that much difference. Chris Wokes, we know that the England team has an issue with players that rhyme with Oaks. Chris Wokes is just not a substitute, nor is Ben Folkes, for that matter. So it's they've got more difficulties than they know what to do with. Look, I think they're stuck with picking the same team, and hopefully the conditions will be somewhat different. It's those very flat wickets where England seems to get found out. You know, their best few days in the series was when they got the opportunity to bowl in helpful conditions in Adelaide, and the two teams, the difference between the two teams did narrow. But once again, that's another thing that people foresaw, that Adelaide, because of the volatility of conditions, would be their best opportunity, and they ended up not taking it. You might consider Root moving to number three. To me, Vince Vince is an attractive stroke maker, but he doesn't look like the kind of guy who's going to carve out a major innings on this tour. I wouldn't be surprised if 83 remains his top scorer, and we've already seen the best of him. Root, I think, would quite like to bat number three, but he feels as though that leaves the middle even more exposed than it already is. Maybe he'll reconsider on the basis of Milan's form. But asking Vince to shoulder the burden of number three, I think, is asking quite a lot of a guy who's averaging in the low 20s. He's not a reassuring size as he comes to the wicket. He looks, it's going to be attractive, but it's going to be temporary. As far as the bowling's concerned, I really think that some people will want to give Mason Crane a run, but I really think that you could probably do him more harm than good. Under these circumstances, I don't think he's as good a bowler as Daniel Fallons, the guy who bowled in the CA11 game. I think he's probably behind him as far as looking at them, relatively speaking. He got a bit of a touch-up in the tour games. I think it's primarily a learning experience. You've got to back Moeen under these circumstances, even though he's having a rather anonymous tour. That's really, I know it's more of the same, but I think the change is that if they were going to get made, probably should have been made before now. You might have considered Root, Cook dropping down to number three, but that was a step that they probably could have taken during the English summer. And other than that, Stokes' unavailability and the injuries to Roland Jones and to Finn have limited their options. I think Finn is a bowler that they've really missed here. I think he would have bowled well in Perth. He's got that extra height. He's got that extra grunt. But they really do look very, very samey when pitches flatten out.
Yeah, Gids, pitches have been a big focus this series. And now, as we kind of navel gaze or we look back really at what has happened to the England side this series, a lot of commentators are pointing to the county competition as kind of the reason for this, I guess, systemic malaise, if you will, but particularly their inability to produce raw, fast, quick, aggressive alpha bowlers, which obviously Australian conditions lend themselves to. Are slow pitches the real reason that, and county, is that the real reason behind why England fails to produce these kind of quicks, or is there a more, sociological, academic explanation for it?
Well, I think there might be a technical explanation. I know that that there's a good deal of criticism on how they're coaching fast bowling in England, that you tend to have bowlers bowling with actions modified to minimise the strain on their physique. Wokes is a classic example. He's a guy who just basically runs through the crease. He doesn't run up and gather. There's no explosive force. He's never really going to bowl any quicker than the low 130s. And if that's the way in which pace bowlers are encouraged to bowl, then you're never going to get anyone who's going to break 140. I think England is lulled into a false sense of security every year because they get to play on their own surfaces, and those kind of bowlers can chip away and take advantage. But the lack of versatility is going to be more starkly revealed when Anderson retires. It is interesting that in Perth, basically England had the same opening bowlers as they had in 2013-14, and Broad and Anderson have been around for a long time. The Australian attack has been completely rebuilt since 2013-14. It's just as formidable. I'm not sure that, we don't necessarily have the same reserves here. It'll be interesting to see how the attack goes if Bird plays as expected in Melbourne. A few of our guys have fallen over, our second stringers, like your Coulter Niles and your Berendorfs and your Moody's. So, we do depend on the best three or four being kept consistently fit. So kudos to the high-performance people for bringing them together and making them last as much of the series as they had. But, that still leaves us three ahead of England and a fair bit of daylight between the two countries.
It's interesting, Gideon. Although, is it not the case, right? I'm sitting here in London. I managed to watch the English summer here when they knocked over South Africa and the West Indies, and everyone was excited about what Anderson and Broad were doing, and Roland Jones, and cricket kind of does have a small window, at least, where it's there's a fair bit of attention paid to it over here. Is it not the case that in 18 months' time, we're just going to be talking about the lessons that England are doling out to us in Australia about how to play cricket on the, you know, when there's sideways movement. And so the cycle will continue. I mean, they may do well in the World Cup as well. Is it more important to win at home than it is to win away?
Well, I mean, it's perfectly foreseeable. You know, I wrote yesterday that it's taken Australia slightly longer to regain the Ashes than it took them to lose in 2015. You know, we are having to get accustomed to these rather explosive, rather brittle teams. No one seems to draw a game these days, except in the case of, you know, major meteorological intervention. And even then, these days, we're so good at adding back time that, you know, it really needs to rain, you know, for a week to finally to rinse a test match out. So, yeah, I mean, I think we're going to have to become accustomed to kind of these high-rolling results. That's just the way in which cricket's played these days. And teams are folding up left, right and centre. It's not just Australia and England that have that problem. You look around and there's no real obvious successors to the mantle of someone like an Alistair Cook. There's no one really around who bats time. That's just not a priority for modern players. And it was interesting in the second innings in Perth. I don't know what you guys thought, but there's been a lot of attention paid to this ball of the century that Stark is meant to have bowled to James Vince. And, it was a good ball, and he probably would have been beaten 100 times out of 100, but he didn't give himself the best opportunity of playing it. No. You know, he's a left-arm bowler bowling with a low arm from round the wicket, and he's trying to bowl cutters, hitting a crack. Okay, it's pretty obvious what he was trying to do. So the way to you know, line yourself up in circumstances like that is to maybe take an off-stump guard, and to, you know, the big risk is nicking off under those circumstances, but he tries to play it with this sort of magnificent flamboyant shot through mid-wicket. Funny thing is, people haven't noticed that Wokes got a very similar ball later, and because he'd set himself up to play defensively, he managed to negotiate it. But these guys, they just don't seem to think about the conditions. They don't seem to think about what bowlers are doing. They just want to play their natural game all the time. You know, back yourself and, you know, play aggressively, move the game on. We used to think that Australians had a monopoly on that kind of thinking. I think the English have got into that mentality, perhaps because Trevor Bayliss was brought in with a mandate to sort of revolutionise England's white ball cricket. And because they've been relatively successful doing that, that kind of culture has seeped into their test game as well.
Very good insights, kids. Just last one before you go. Steve Smith, I mean, honestly, it's just getting beyond a joke now. He is ridiculously dominant. No one seems to know how to bowl to him or how to figure him out. People don't understand why he's good, but he is. He averaged 142 this series. And you know, if you put aside the three-pronged pace attack, as you said, he really was the difference. So there's just so much talk now about him, and you're a man of cricket history, so much talk about him being the best since Bradman. People rolling out statistics. Is he?
Well, I mean, he's you know, when you talk about Bradman, you talk about how much better he was than the opposition and any other player in his era. He's obviously not that, because there are players who are, you know, within cooey. But what has impressed me this summer, and has impressed me for a while, is his capacity to adapt to conditions. You know, the fact that he scored his slowest test century in Brisbane with barely a run in front of point on the offside, to making his fastest test century in Perth, where a third of his runs came through the covers. You know, what do you do under when a player is that flexible, is that capable of reading the game and working out, you know, what are the percentages that work in my favour? That's a very formidable player, and he's, you know, talking earlier about Vince. That's precisely what he doesn't do, and what Smith does. I mean, what an object lesson in reading the game and adapting your batting style to circumstances. He's also got, you know, prodigious concentration. It's interesting that, you know, you look at him and you, because he is so agitated and so animated at the crease, you think he must use up a lot of nervous energy, but somehow it doesn't. That doesn't seem to be the case. It's almost like that kind of, his little sort of act of performance art as a preliminary to each delivery is kind of earthing him, is kind of stabilising him. I was interested that England did manage to get inside his head in Adelaide. There's no doubt about that. He is a player who likes to control things. He likes things just so. Reading his autobiography, I was fascinated by all the little rituals that he talked about, all the little obsessions that he has, such as, you know, taping his shoelaces to his shoes. Okay, that's a guy who thrives in that environment of controlling their immediate surroundings. Perhaps the way is to try and get inside his head. And it was interesting that England didn't seem to try to do that in Perth. It was almost as though he batted so fluently and so authoritatively straight away that they were put on the back foot somewhat. But, you know, when Smith is that good, he is capable of dictating the terms of the game. And he's got a psychological edge, especially over his counterpart as captain. You know, these two guys went into the series. A lot of the pre-match was kind of framed in terms of the head-to-head of these two brilliant young batsmen and virtuoso captains. Well, I'm sure that the respective averages, 142 versus 29, don't reflect their talents, but it's almost as though Smith's achievements have intimidated Root, that Root is feeling the pressure of not being able to measure up for his own side with performances of a similar stature.
A wonderful summary capturing it all, Gideon. That's probably all we got time for, unfortunately, but again, I'd just get lost in the speaking of virtuoso words. I was just getting lost in that
spoken imagery. Word.
Yeah. Thank you so much for coming on the show again, Gideon. Best of luck to the Yarras as well, most importantly.
Indeed. Thanks very much, boys.
It can be hard to leave grade cricket. The relentless nudity, champing and macho horseplay can have a debilitating lasting effect.
Hi, darling. How was your day?
Yeah, not bad, bud.
Can you please stop calling me bud?
So when you do call time on your 8-year, barely memorable career, you need all the help you can get. That's why we started the Grade Cricket Rehabilitation Centre. Using state-of-the-art cognitive behavioural therapy, the Grade Cricket Rehabilitation Centre will help you reintegrate back into normal society just like your family wanted.
Hello, darling. How was your day?
Good, thanks. And how was yours?
It was wonderful. You're coming along so well.
Yeah, cheers, champ. Oh, wait. Thank you very much. I appreciate your help.
The Grade Cricket Rehabilitation Centre. There is a way out of this.
Well, boys, it's been hard not to fawn over the last couple of weeks with the guests that we've had, and it gets even harder this week. The numbers, as always, Simon Kadich. He played 56 tests for Australia over 10 years, hit 10 test tons, took a sixfer, once hit 306 against Queensland as part of a 1,500-run Take That Selectors season. Though to many, that's not even the most impressive bit, because let's face it, for many cricketers, Kadich was our spirit animal, the captain of the Good Blokes 11. And Brett Lee said it best when he said, if you don't get on with Kadich, you're a pretty ordinary bloke. So let's hope we get on with Kadich. Simon, welcome to the Great Cricketer, mate.
Thanks very much for having me.
No worries. Look, we always start the same way, Caddo, and I will call you Caddo if that's okay, because Chris Rogers gave me a number and it was down there as Caddo, so I hope I'm not sort of jumping the gun there. But
it's all good.
Your domestic career in Australia took you from WA to New South Wales. Can you tell us a little bit about your grade cricket experiences in both states?
Yeah, look, I was very fortunate to start my grade career at a magnificent club in Perth, Midland Guildford Cricket Club. And I started there when I think I was about 10 years old, playing under 13s for Midland Guildford, and then just progressed through the age groups, and then eventually got to first grade cricket when I was still at school at 16.
And eventually.
To play with, in terms
wait.
Of our club, I got to play with Tom Moody, Brendan Julian, Joe Angel, Tim Zura, all these guys that had played, a lot of state cricket and also international cricket. So, to be mentored by them and to also have a great mentor at Midland Guildford in a lot of those guys throughout the years. He also coached Alex Stewart, who ended up obviously playing, 140 tests for England. So, magnificent club. To play at Lilac Hill is probably the flattest wicket in the country, so not a bad place as a young batsman to grow up. And then, to have all those guys around and share a dressing room with them, I look back now and think I was really blessed to, as a 16, 17-year-old to have learnt from all those guys, and to, some of my best memories in cricket are from those days sitting in the dressing rooms with them having a few beers after play. So I learned a lot about cricket there and then. And then I was fortunate when I moved to Sydney in 2002. I never thought I'd move states, but it happened. And when I moved, Mike Whitney, I think, was probably the first one that called me, and he was president of Randwick Petersham. And then, I played another sort of 12 years there for Randwick, Randwick Petersham. So, another very, very well-run club, really good people involved. And one thing I think I prided myself on my whole career was always going back and playing club cricket when I could, depending on how the schedule worked out and all that sort of stuff. And my time in Sydney was, very enjoyable as well. Getting to play at Coogee Oval and Petersham Oval. Mm. I think Petersham Oval is the ground where Sir Donald Bradman scored his first grade 100. So there's a fair bit of history in Sydney grade cricket. And, I've been very lucky to have played at two magnificent clubs throughout my career.
What do you think about the difference between the New South Wales and the WA grade scene, like key kind of differences between the two? Because obviously here in Sydney there is a sense of superiority. Sydney Test cricket is the best form of amateur cricket in the world. There's a sense of superiority over here and it's warranted. But if you're able to kind of break down the differences, having played at both of them for so long, can you kind of outline the difference, or is it exactly the same?
I think the biggest difference, that's a good point, the biggest difference is the conditions. So I think in Perth, the wickets don't tend to spin as much. Some of them do in club cricket, but here in Sydney, you get a lot of wickets that as the day goes on, they tend to take a bit of turn and the spinners bowl a lot of overs. So, that's the biggest difference I saw. I don't think there was a huge amount of difference in the level of cricket. It's just a different style of game because of the wickets. So, that's probably the biggest difference. It's hard because when I was younger playing in Perth, you always think it's probably harder because you're still making your way. And then when you're established and you feel like you're already playing well at the level above and you come back to club cricket, you don't feel that it's as big a test as when you're younger. But I always found that club cricket was always a big test because you don't always know the opposition, you don't always know the conditions. And so regardless of whether you come back from a state game or a test or whatever it is, I always treated it with respect because I knew anyone could knock you over and anyone could whack my bowling to six anywhere. it didn't matter where I was bowling.
Yeah. And tell all their mates about it at the water cooler on Monday.
Oh, exactly. No one misses you, that's for sure. So it doesn't matter where you've been playing, you're fair game. So that's the beauty of club cricket.
Kat, you sort of spoke before about how, you're sort of playing first grade with, Joe Angel and Tom Moody and then Brendan Julian as well, like heroes of yours, no doubt, growing up in the West. Brendan Julian's been on this show and he's probably one of our most revered guests in a lot of ways, certainly from me, because I think he's my mum's favourite cricketer. So,
female's favourite cricketer. Yeah.
I think it was the bowling action, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, what was BJ like, as a young 16-year-old, as you said, playing first grade? Did he sort of take you under his wing? Were you struck by his beauty? Did you look into his eyes? I mean, what was BJ like to you as a young man?
Well, I tell you right now, whenever we went out for a beer, he was always swamped by female attention, but he tended to be quite oblivious to it all. So if he'd been as ruthless as some of my other teammates, who knows what could have happened. But the one memory I have of BJ playing club cricket was standing at second slip for a ball off him one day, and I took it to my right at second slip. He didn't even hit the cut stuff. So BJ, I guess he was just a freak in that, you know, he'd roll up, wouldn't do much warm-ups, and he'd just come out and he'd bowl these unbelievable balls, and then he'd whack a few, or if he got out, he got out. He was pretty laid back about it all. You know, he probably should have played more cricket for Australia. He was that talented, but just that era he played in, you know, there was obviously a magnificent Australian team. So, but in terms of playing with him, yeah, I wouldn't say I sat there and admired his beauty, because I'm not that way inclined. But in terms of, not that there's anything wrong with that, but you know, he's obviously, as I said before, you know, most of the females that did follow cricket back then certainly, you know, took a shine to him and his looks, and you know, he was certainly a character.
Did you expect to speak for 3 minutes about Brendan Julian on this cast? No, that's not the question, Simon. Just to lead into this, I'm really curious about the way international or professional cricket has come back to club cricket. You know, the three of us played in Sydney and would have had opportunities at different stages to see you play for Randwick Petersham. And I have one particular memory watching you play once, and like, you were very insistent, you probably don't even remember this, but you and Nathan Horitz were playing for Randwick Petersham, and you were insistent on wearing the Randwick Petersham kit, you know, the Randwick Petersham helmet, etc. But you know, there's a lot of pro players who come back to grade cricket and make sure they wear the state kit, you know, or the international kit. I mean, what's your policy on that when it comes to heading back to club cricket?
You know, my policy is, I saw plenty of guys do that in England in county cricket or playing over there, and we used to hop into them if they did that. You know, someone came back wearing an England helmet or something like that. So there was no way in the world I was going to have double standards about that sort of stuff. So I did manage to have Randwick did have a navy sort of green helmet. So I was fortunate that I played in a Bradman 11 game, which was the same colour, and just whacked the Randwick badge on the front, so I was perfect for my whole Randwick career. But I was never going to wear a state helmet back in club cricket, that's for sure.
Kat, I just want to move on to your professional days and more specifically your Australian career. And I suppose that towards the very beginning of your career, you found yourself in India in 2004 when Australia famously won for the first time in, you know, a million years. Do you have any sort of lasting memories or something that really sticks in the mind when you think about that series?
I guess the thing for us was that, you know, we hadn't won there for so long. The guys got close in 2001, and Steve Waugh, you know, said it was the final frontier for him. He pretty much achieved everything in the game, and then he didn't quite get there because he retired early 2004, and then we were there later that year, I think in October. So I just remember Adam Gilchrist getting the captaincy because Ricky Ponting busted his thumb in the Champions Trophy in England soon before that, and Gilly did an amazing job as captain, and he basically just said to us, look, you know, we're going to play their style of cricket for these four tests, and we've always come here and played really aggressive attacking cricket, and it doesn't work. And so we played their style, and it did, and the way things panned out, we were fortunate that in the, you know, the big test match where it counted in Nagpur, the third test, they produced a wicket with a fair bit of grass on it, and it basically favoured us, and the rest is history. We were up, so it was an amazing experience, and probably to this day, I'd say it was, for me and the Australian Test team, it was probably my greatest achievement being part of that team.
It's really interesting you say that, Kat, because I mean, particularly looking at this Ashes series and the conversation around, you know, what it means for teams to be great now, given that it just seems like home teams win. The only mark of greatness in cricket now is winning when the conditions don't favour you. I mean, would you agree with that? And you know, do you see any opportunities on the horizon for teams to kind of break out of the mould of simply winning at home? I mean, for example, you know, now that Australia's won the Ashes at home, you know, do you see them being a chance of winning in England in 18 months' time?
Look, it's certainly something that the guys will be driven towards. I was really impressed with our team in India early this year. I was fortunate to be there for the first couple of tests And the way they played and handled themselves, such a young team, you know, they certainly earned a lot of respect over there. So even though they ended up losing, I thought, you know, it was a really good sign. They did a lot of good preparation beforehand. And, you know, it's still quite a young team that's evolving. So you'd like to think in the next couple of years, if they can keep this attack on the park and a few of the batsmen start to get better playing away from home, because I think a lot of our batsmen have done really well here in Australia. They've just now got to obviously step it up overseas and turn into, you know, fantastic players overseas as well. So a lot of it comes down to experience and just getting, you know, getting acclimatised to those conditions. So hopefully, yeah, we can win the Ashes in England in a couple of years, and hopefully we can start, you know, winning in India again as well.
Well, Kat, I think, well, at the moment it's Warner and Bancroft. They're Australia's latest odd couple openers. Warner's already forecast a long and fruitful union with Cam Bancroft, just as he did with Matt Renshaw and every other partner before that. But I'm just wondering, you as an opening batsman, who is your kind of, you know, you go out there and you, I guess the opening batsman, it's kind of a club, isn't it? You go out there and you build relationships with that player. Who was the kind of your best opening partner over all those years?
Well, it was hard because I sort of only sort of came into it by default on the West Indies tour in 2008, and Matty Hayden got injured, and so as a result, I got the opportunity to open with Phil Jakes, and I always loved batting with Jakesy because we played a lot together for New South Wales. We tended to run between the wickets well and got on well, so that was good. And then unfortunately, Jakesy's back went not long after that tour, and then Haydos was back in, and Haydos obviously had a very close relationship, some might say too close, to Justin Langer, but you know, those two were obviously like husband and wife, and we always joke that Justin was the female in the relationship. But you know, those two, you know, they had a bond that was always going to be hard for me to sort of take over from Alfie with Haydos. So that was good. I enjoyed being with Haydos. He was obviously a legend. And then after that, you know, I got to, when Phil Hughes started his career, you know, I loved batting with him because we'd played a fair bit for New South Wales. And, you know, I'll never forget that first tour in South Africa and seeing how much joy he brought the whole group with the way he played in, you know, that test series. So, you know, those three stood out. But I guess the one I did, you know, enjoyed opening the best with was definitely Shane Watson. We were the odd couple. There's no doubt about that. He didn't have a hair on his body, and I was like a werewolf. So, yeah, in terms of, we couldn't have been any more odd. But, look, we loved batting together. He was, you know, he was nice and aggressive. I was happy just to bide my time. And I think over that sort of 2 or 3 year period that we opened together from, I think, England 2009 till the end when my career ended, for about 2 years, we had a really good time together. Apart from a couple of dodgy run-outs where he, I couldn't hear his calls and he didn't call, probably.
Where it was his fault.
Project his voice better. Yeah.
Well, Kat, there's a good chance that might come up again later. But you know, you sort of batted all over the place. You know, obviously you started batting at six, and it's so hard to, you know, speak about, for instance, the 2005 Ashes, which I'm sure you've been asked a million times. But when we've only got you for a few minutes, but I want to talk about specifically that Edgbaston test, the second test where Australia just fell short in the run chase by about 2 or 3 runs. You were obviously in the sheds watching Kasperwitz and Brett Lee put on about 60 for the last wicket. Can you sort of give us a sense of what the mood was like, you know, as the runs got closer and closer, and then what it was like afterwards? Did you sense then that you know, that Ashes was going to be so close as it was, or did you think that, you know, Australia had underperformed in that test match and you just go again in the third test?
Look, obviously, we were really confident after we won at Lords, and then we went to Edgbaston, and just the way things panned out, with Pigeon rolling his ankle in the warm-up, and then we won the toss of bowled, and then once England made 400 on that first day, you're always playing catch-up. So I think in the way it panned out, I mean, I think from 100 runs on, we were counting down on a piece of paper, and a few of us, I think it was myself and a few of the other batsmen that had already gotten out, and We wouldn't move because we're obviously a bit superstitious. And once the partnership formed, we were like, we're not going anywhere. So, and at the end, we thought, we're getting home here. And and I'll never forget, Brett Lee smoked one out to deep point.
Yeah, fully.
A couple of metres either way, and we were home. And I can't remember who saved it. Someone dived and saved it. And we were like, we couldn't believe it. But, I mean, the way the way that Test series panned out, I mean, it was such a great series. Yes, it was disappointing we lost, but if anything, it did Test cricket the world of good in England, and that's probably at the time what it needed. But, you know, bitterly disappointed to be, you know, part of it and not perform as well as I would have liked. And, you know, there was a few of us that underperformed, and as a result, you know, we didn't bat well enough to win the series.
So just picking up on something there, Caddo, this wasn't a pre-planned question. So you said everyone was, like, nobody moved for that partnership of 60-odd, and then Australia lost. So I guess my question is, who moved?
Yeah. Well, Warney stood on his trumps, on his stumps, so he moved. But, other than that, in the rooms, yeah, I can't remember. Someone must have, because it definitely put the jinx on us.
That would definitely be the Fox Sports article tomorrow.
Who was policing that? Like, who was the policing of the don't move policy? Someone, like, walking around got, is it John Buchanan?
Yeah, probably Bucky was pretty pretty much into all those sort of things. So I'll blame everything gets blamed on Buck, so I might as well blame him for it.
That's good. Caddo, in the interest of time, we're stealing your time like we stole Mike Atherton's last week, and he just ended up getting off the phone when he was ready. So please feel free to...
Yeah, that won't happen because I want us to win 5-0.
To the same. Exactly. Yeah, take that, Athers.
So I'm not going to jinx us.
We'll move to the throwdown section. Obviously, there's so many things we could be talking to about, Caddo, as well. But we'll move to the throwdown section. No doubt you're very familiar with it. But let's just see how we go anyway. I'll kick it off with a soft one. Caddo, in a Randwick Petersham fourth grade semi final against Balmain in 2002, a then young batsman by the name of Michael Watson broke his bat early in his innings at Coogee Oval. You probably don't remember this, but you, a Test player watching on, proceeded to give him one of your bats at lunch. He then went on to make an unbeaten 100, leaving him with an indelible memory for life. Given that he went on to make a ton, do you regret giving him that particular bat?
And I do remember it, and no, I don't regret, because thankfully I had a few sitting in the bag, so I was pretty fortunate that I could be generous enough to give him one, and I'm pretty sure I'd let him keep it.
I'll have to ask him.
Kat, I hope this one doesn't offend you too much, but when I think back to images of you on the field, I always, just always remember you being really dirty, like covered with grass stains and dust and all that kind of stuff. And I'm just wondering why that is, and, like, did you not enjoy washing your own whites, or what was the situation there?
Well, Mark Waugh always used to say I was the dirtiest cricketer going around. That's on the field, that is.
Yes.
And the reason being... I think it became a superstition of mine that whenever I dived for a single and got in and got dirty, I invariably end up going on and getting a big score. So the boys reckon I used to just deliberately dive early on to get dirty. And I'd be playing mind games with myself.
Yeah, just single to long on. Just dive in.
Superstition.
Kat, people have been speculating a lot recently that this current Australian tack is the greatest of all time. But, I mean, how annoyed are you that there isn't more praise for the 2003 attack against Zimbabwe that included Williams, Bickle, Hogg and Tadich?
Yeah, look, it's a big call on that one over that attack there, particularly with two Chinamen in the team. I mean, when you're having to deal with two Chinamen, particularly contrasting Chinamen, one with his tongue hanging out and one... with a full body coverage of hair. It's not the easiest thing to do, concentrating. But in terms of our attack now, you know, I think it's very good. It's got a lot of balance to it. Obviously, you know, if they throw a fifth option in there now with Mitch Marsh being in the team, it gives them that little bit of extra cover in tougher wickets. But it's always hard to compare eras because, I mean, any team that had Warne, McGrath, Gillespie and then Lee or... Kasperitz or Bickle or, you know, whoever, Fleming, Rifle, one of those guys, you know, hard to compare because they're all great. And I think these young guys will, by the end of their careers, if they stay in the park, they'll go down, they'll be right alongside a lot of those guys.
Caddo, cricketers are fixated with binary understandings of things, you know, black, white, good, bad, fast, slow. I just want to know, if you're the captain of the Australian cricket Good Blokes 11... from 2001 to 2011, who else is in that side? Maybe name it. Maybe name two or three players in the Good Blokes 11 of the Australian cricketers over that 10-year period.
If there are two.
Well, it's a tough one because I could rattle off that many names. You know, in terms of that era I got to play in, there's not too many that I wouldn't have on that list. So, you could almost put the lot in. But in terms of the guys I got on well with, I tended to hang around with the quicks a lot, the fast bowlers cartels. So Fleming, Gillespie, Lee, McGrath, all those guys. Spent a fair bit of time playing county cricket with Warnie over the years. He was always good value. In terms of now, I'm always in touch with Justin Langer, and I see Matty Hayden a bit, Hussey a bit around the trap. So there's that many of them. Could keep going on and on.
Tad actually wrote a three-part fan fiction series a few years ago entitled The Choke, which looked at the fallout from the dressing room altercation between yourself and Michael Clark. Now, clearly this incident split the team into two lines, you know, much like Christos Tsiolkos' novel The Slap. Can I send that to you for feedback? Because I think you'll like it.
I think you've just got good feedback, haven't you?
Fan fiction.
Fan fiction. Kato, Boxing Day 2009. You and Shane Watson, you alluded to it before, were involved in a run out against Pakistan where you both ended up at the same end and the third umpire was required to see who would be given out. Shane was given out, run out for 93, and that was his third time being out in the 90s before his first test century. Has he ever spoken to you again, and what did he say when you got out a short time later for 98?
I'll tell you what he said. As he was trying to dive into the crease while I was watching the ball at backward point, he was behind me and I had no idea he was there. All I heard was this, "Oh, cat," in this whiny voice. And I had no idea where he was. And so the dirty bugger tried to run me out. So, look, disappointing that he would try and do that to his opening partner, but I had no idea where he was because I was busy watching the ball and he must have called. I'd called wait, but obviously with 60,000 people full of booze on Boxing Day, I didn't hear a thing. And, it was mid-afternoon and, there was a mix-up. But, we've spoken since and we have a laugh about it. So there's no great dramas, really. These things happen. He got me back in the next year, first over against England at Adelaide, and I didn't even get to face the ball. So we were pretty even then.
That's great. I didn't know you could do impressions. That was fantastic. Kato, you actually had quite an underrated rig. You might still as well. You definitely weren't given enough credit for it at the time. I just went to like.
Mate, it's amazing. It's amazing what modern technology can do. So I wouldn't read too much into those.
Well,
photos.
It's funny you say that because I was just trying to promote you being on the show and went on Google Images. I literally just typed in Simon Kadich and half of the Google Images are of you shirtless. And it's something to behold. So you obviously worked really hard on it. I'm just wondering where you think you sat in the dressing room pecking order of rigs after Shane Watson during your test career.
I never thought about it, to be honest, but like all good things, you do it for charity. I did it for the McGrath Foundation. So, I thought I better make sure that I'm, in reasonable nick, but end of the day, that's just how I came, mate. I had hair on my chest and that's how nature intended me to look.
Very good. Kat, in the semi-finals of Celebrity MasterChef Australia, you wowed Matt Preston with your signature dish of crispy salmon with wilted spinach and mashed potatoes. Where does this rank among your life accomplishments and how intimidating is George Calambaris?
Look, the hardest thing about MasterChef, because I love my cooking and I didn't think I'd do anything like that sort of stuff, but I love cooking, so I thought, why not, I'll go on it. But the hardest thing about the semi-finals was that for 90 minutes, I had to cook behind Miss Universe Australia, Rachel Finch, so I had absolutely no chance of being able to concentrate, and hence I got kicked out.
It's in your eye line, just like someone at short mid-wicket.
Yeah, wilted spinach. Yep. A good metaphor. Yeah,
so unfortunately, that was the end of me. I was done.
Simon, you've come through the gauntlet of throwdowns. Well done. I can't believe you just let us keep going there. Normally, we just get cut off. But it was very very kind of you to endure all that. And thanks for joining us on the show. We've really enjoyed having you.
My pleasure, guys.
Harry Broad, good morning. You've been reading The Great Cricketer.
But most of the book has taken up with proving he isn't good enough. Locker room language is rife and sexual immaturity is rampant. Having sexual relations is called burgling a chop. I'm very disappointed. I thought this should be a great book.
Those are the two voices that you've just heard of Gideon Hay and Simon Kadich. A terrific show this week. Thanks, as ever, for tuning in. But now it is the final segment before Christmas 2017. Hashtag AskTGC, where we answer the questions that you've asked to us using the hashtag AskTGC. So we'll start this off with Chardonnay Crows, who writes in, "Great cricketer, I drew the office IT girl for my work's Secret Santa, requiring me to purchase her a $15 gift. Seeing as I don't know any of her interests, do you think it's safe to assume I could just buy her a copy of Tea and No Sympathy and hope she likes grade cricket?"
Thanks, Chardonnay Crows. I suppose it's not safe because it's $30. So, you might have to chip in a little bit more. But otherwise, I definitely think that... there's a lot in there for females who wish to understand the deep dysfunction of men playing sport.
Yeah, and all those male listeners out there who do have significant others or friends that are females, you know, if you've got a couple in there, perhaps you do. Maybe you can push the grey cricketer Tea No Sympathy towards them, because we are hoping to reach a wider audience than just bloated blokes who play lower level Shires cricket, which hopefully that's what you are.
Stuart Kemp says, "I've been living in the UK for 3 years now, and no, I won't lower myself to ask for a beer with the bald one who lives in the UK. Anywho, I recently flew home for the first time for a close friend's wedding. Jet-lagged as fuck on the day of the wedding, I decided I would help take the covers off at 8 a.m. at my local club, whilst my perplexed British girlfriend waited in the car watching four men who clearly don't like each other try and fold up a giant piece of plastic sheet. I don't even play or like cricket anymore, yet this is the first thing I choose to do when I get back. What the fuck is wrong with me? Please help, Stu."
I mean, it's like turning up in the morning and like lifting the covers off the wicket. There's something like funereal about that, like walking with three other blokes just silently in unison, kind of like, you know, carrying a casket towards a gravesite. Like, just you just do it. You're bound by this duty of the game. You hate cricket. The game fucking hates you. So short answer, I don't know why you've done this. And yeah, there's probably something wrong with you. Yeah.
Charles Brunker writes in and he says, "A professor at my alma mater, Shel Schoenhart Bailey, developed and employed cutting-edge textual analysis software to analyse verbatim transcripts from the Federal Reserve's open market committee meetings in order to better understand monetary policy decisions in the United States. Do you think the professor is wasting her time with trivial matters when she should really be using her considerable skills to determine which sledges are most effective? If she did do this, what would you expect her to find?"
We enjoy these ironically highbrow questions, don't we? Just juxtaposing textual analysis software with sledging effectiveness.
I think, if that software was developed, it would sell quite well. I'd certainly want to be investing. I think there's a lot of grade clubs out there that would be investing in that. I mean, this is a sort of big data insights we need. I don't need to know what a good length is or a short length or, like, revs on the ball or the amount that, you know, it's deviated. I want big data, like, textual analysis on the effectiveness of sledging for sure.
I mean, I reckon she would find a lot of repetition, though. Like, I don't think you need a very sophisticated algorithm to understand which sledges are most effective, because they're mostly just about your aesthetics or about your family and why your dad hates you, and that's how you get blokes out.
Do you think it's also, like, who it's delivered by as well? Like, if someone with good pipes and levers standing at second slip with, like, speed dealer sunnies and they've scored sort of... Like, it's kind of... It's proportionate to the amount of runs they've scored or how well they've done in grade cricket and what they look like when you turn around and see who's done it.
Well, the software wouldn't analyse that, because that's not a textual analysis. That's actually just a bloke at Gully who's sledging you with great pipes and chest.
There's a limit to the software. And Schoenhart Bailey, I can imagine if she's written a report, like perhaps in the synopsis, it would say, language used is relative to the pipes and levers of the person using it.
Okay. Question asked and answered. Michael Murphy says, "I'm not a cricket nuffy, but I did catch some of the cricket show yesterday and noticed at the end of their interview with Michael Clarke, they had a segment called Overthrows. Obviously, this is a poor man's throwdowns. How do you feel about Channel 9 ripping off your ideas? Hashtag AskTGC." Dave, you want to take that one?
Okay, here goes. Look, it is disappointing. obviously, some low-level Channel 9 producer listens to our cast and thought, throwdowns, that's a great idea. I'll steal that. It's not like the grade cricketers have a legal team or anything, so it should be sweet. And it's got up as a concept. 3 minutes with Warnie, overthrows. What a winner. Mate, I'm livid, and I've got my lawyers on it.
Pez?
Yeah, well, it's good that we'll probably get plenty of work with Channel 9 as well, now that we're just completely...
Yeah, give us a call.
I have to say... I haven't seen the segment. You guys have seen it. Like, obviously, overthrows sounds like throwdowns. They have two syllables, and it's something that happens in cricket. I mean, do the comparisons, you know, end there?
Well, the questions aren't wild and far ranging as ours. They're pretty basic. It's basically, well, how would you describe it? He goes, they sit down with, you know, a KP or a Warnie. Slats usually does the interviews. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and there's basically a timer on the clock, and then they just ask as many questions from the fans as possible, and it's as dull as you'd expect. So, yeah, Channel 9, give us a call. Tom Brooks says, if we frame everything via narrative, as we're now legally obliged to do, does Bairstow's Redemption 100 narrative trump the Weird Bloke narrative? And if it doesn't, at the time of writing, will it if he gets it in a losing side?
Yeah, very good question, Tom. I mean, when we were pondering this after the headbutt scandal, it was just sort of off the top of my head, sort of back of a cigarette packet kind of calculation that he needed 300s to trump the weird bloke narrative. It was a very, very good 100. And I think for a day or so after Bairstow's 100, there was a lot of respect for him as a player. And the fact that he headbutted his helmet was a great way of kind of making light of what had happened. But a few days after that, and particularly given how many people seem to be really keen to say that Johnny Bairstow is a socially awkward person, which I find awkward itself, because he seems to be fine to me, I'm thinking that the weird bloke narrative is still kind of ahead. I think he needs a couple more tons to trump it. It's hard to trump the weird bloke once you get tarred with it.
All right. Dan Hughes says, Payne has been impressively neat with the gloves, long sleeves, pads on outside, and A-grade speed dealers. Best yet, he loves a cheeky roll at the stumps after collecting dot balls too. Is he one of our greats already? Hashtag AskTGC. Lads, if you don't mind being the wicketkeeper of the trio or at one stage of my life, I hope you don't mind if I just quickly take this one on. And I actually think there's nothing more village than a wicketkeeper rolling the ball at the stumps, attempting a stumping from back in the crease. I know he's obviously playing international cricket, and he may be allowed to do that in some capacity, but to me it just looks absolutely yuck. Thoughts?
He goes, you've read our collective minds on that. It is yuck. It's unclean. It's a village. As a bowler, well, I was a batsman, but I also bowled a bit of seam up. I was always scared of keepers doing this and then it being credited as a stumping against my name, because it would just indicate that I had a severe lack of pace, which I did, but I didn't want it going down in a scorebook, as we talked about before, how much I revere the scorebook. But aesthetics dictate that it's unclean and yuck.
Yeah. All right.
Sorry, Dave. I said the same way, but just to be fair to Tim Payne, everything else about him looks exceptionally clean.
Oh, yes,
I actually don't think I've seen a cleaner Australian wicketkeeper from an aesthetic point of view in my lifetime. I mean, Healy, I suppose, was very, very clean as a keeper, but even just like Payne's shapes are really good. Like just his, the angularity of his body and just even the symmetry of his face just looks really good with the way the baggy green falls over it as well, so I'm really happy from that point of view.
Citizen 39 says, Grey cricketer, 239, but Steve Smith's technique makes him a rare unit. He turns up for a first net batting like that, and he's struggling to make fours. The only rare unit to Captain Oz? It's a poorly framed question.
Oh, my God. It's a strange question. Like it ends really abruptly. The only rare unit to Captain Oz? Well, if I look at it from that perspective and we go back, I can't think of a... I think Kim Hughes was called a rare unit. He was before our time, but that was because he cried at a press conference, I think. And obviously there are strict rules here in Australia surrounding overt displays of emotion by men. Like, never cry publicly, never show any vulnerability ever, obviously, even when you're literally dying inside. And that's not a good way to live, but that's the rules of masculinity here in Australia. I don't write the rules. But in terms of the only rare unit to Captain Oz, is there anyone else rarer than Steve Smith? And does his technique make him a rare unit? Are those correlated?
Yeah, I think there's a very interesting conversation going on in Australia at the moment where they're reckoning with the fact that, like, our captain is just annihilating everybody and we just are gluttonous for runs at all times. But we still can't quite make the leap to accept him just because he looks strange with the way he holds the bat. And even, like, even though people rightly point out, well, Bradman was like that too. Like, Bradman's different.
I
still feel like
on
some level we haven't accepted him.
The art of cricket. So maybe Steve Smith needs to write a book of his own I guess justifying his technique, and a major publishing house needs to take that on board and get it out there, distro it out.
Distro.
Shane Herps writes in, and he finishes off the show this week with the question of the week. He says, "G'day, gents. With the monster partnership between Smith and Marsh, the attention of most was diverted towards one of either two things. A, how freakish Smith is, or B, how Mitch Marsh scored a run at all. However, more astute watchers would have witnessed a far more intriguing and complex phenomenon unfolding. With Smith, and the junior Marsh, we witnessed two binary microcosms of Australian cricketing subculture pitted against each other. The more progressive and meritorious selection in Smith, despite fucking village shapes, levers resembling pipe cleaners rather than pipes, a shit salad and a pin head, he has managed to become the world's best. Still, beater as fuck. Opposing this was, while in hindsight a good selection, a somewhat backward step towards rig-based selections in Marsh. Rumoured to be a successful chop merchant, he has pipes, levers, hits it hard, looks good, is a good bloke, according to none other than SK Warren, and has built off the front cover, of a Riggs-Arsaurus catalogue. Riggs are Russ catalogue to match, my apologies. Everything grey cricket stands for, fucking alpha. My question is, can this battle of styles within the same side be read to represent the power struggles going on within Western nations? Western nations. With the West chasing the same goals, think economic prosperity, secure borders, high living standards, etc. We are all really on the same team. Despite this, we're faced with a fight between conservatism, a la Trump, Brexit, etc., and progression, Trudeau, and even Australia of late. Given that Smith outscored Marsh by 50-odd, can I rest easy at night knowing that humanity's future has been guaranteed this week? Or is it not the case, and should I return to worrying about a world controlled by Russian chant bots and Chinese spies?"
Wow.
Yeah. Let's take a moment. Do you have any reaction to that, Higos? I need a moment to compose myself. Mm.
Do I have a reaction to it? No. Well, I mean, here's my initial reaction. The rig works, you know, like backwards progression works. Mm. I think, you know, communism, excellent idea in theory, doesn't work in practice. I'm not sure who's communism in this theory. Maybe Peter Hanscom. But Mitchell Marsh is a backward step towards our primal fears, primitive nature. You know, he's a caveman, Mitch Marsh. He's a caveman with a big club, which is, of course, a euphemism. And he's just whacked England all around the park, and he's won us Australia a test match.
Also a euphemism.
But Steve Smith scored more runs. Nah, I'm still inclined to think that Australia's always going to go for rig-based selection.
Oh, well, haven't we all gotten around the Marshes this past week or so? Like, yeah, to me, it feels like we are going backward. You know, you talk about rig-based selection and so forth, and that's certainly something from a few years back that was very prominent. But, you know, in these uncertain times globally, that's what we do. We return to what we know, rigs and pipes in this case, and Marsh Brothers. We just saw Hanscom get punted for his own beater style, and I think that's instructive to the future of the Australian team. And Western society in general, pipes, levers and chests are the future.
I think that as far as the metaphors are concerned, I think Smith is China in the sense Smith that he's kind of been building an empire for quite a long time. And, you know, people wonder whether China wants to be a little bit more Western or be like the US a bit more in its rise to power. Some would say that it is already the most powerful going on. Marsh is Trump, obviously, and, you know, clinging on desperately, you know, for the old world. We wait and see what the, you know, results of Steve Smith in cricket are, and China in global society. I mean, I certainly wait with bated breath, and you know, hopefully we have a chance to cover that on the Grey Cricketer podcast over the next couple of seasons.
But who's Genghis Khan? That's it for the final show before Christmas. We'll be back next week. Thanks, as ever, to Toby Shane, our producer. My name's Ian Higgins, signing off for myself, Sam Perry, and David Edwards. Have a cracking Christmas. Australia, most likely 4-0 next week. We'll see you then.
Merry Christmas.